This is episode number 2 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, March 1st, 2007. I'm Jerry Brito. Up for discussion this week, the Real ID Act controversy gets hot in the states and in Washington. Representative Rick Boucher introduces a watered-down copyright fair use bill, and Spanish-language broadcaster Univision is slapped with the biggest fine in FCC history. Joining me to discuss these issues is Adam Thier.
Hello, Jerry.
Hello, Adam. Tim Lee.
Hey there, Jerry.
And Jim Harper.
Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Jim. These are contributors to the Technology Liberation Front all. First up, Real ID. Jim, you're a privacy expert. Tell us, what's the Real ID Act, how did it get passed, and what's going on now?
Well, the Real ID Act is a law that passed in May of 2005 that attempts to coerce states into issuing nationally standardized driver's licenses and putting state driver information into nationally accessible databases, nominally for the purpose of security. By May 2008, that's the deadline for the thing. It stripped out provisions in the December 2004 Intelligence Reform Act that would have started to negotiate a rulemaking that made a little bit more sense, though the position I take is that a national ID doesn't really provide much security at all, so we could do without one and be perfectly fine. Today, the Department of Homeland Security, nearly 2 years after passage of the law, and with nearly 1 year to go before states are supposed to implement, DHS came out with regulations that supposedly flesh out what states will have to do. They've been really screaming because they have, like I said, just over a year to comply, but don't know yet what the DHS is going to ask them to do.
So what's the stick here? If the states don't comply and don't standardize their driver's licenses, what happens to them?
Well, then their IDs won't be acceptable for federal purposes, and basically that means a lot of things that don't matter, like access to nuclear facilities. But it also means being able to use an ID to prove who you are at the Transportation Security Administration checkpoint at the airport and wherever else the Department of Homeland Security might put such checkpoints, or for whatever uses the Secretary of Homeland Security decides that IDs should be necessary.
But this is obviously a game of chicken. I mean, the federal government is not going to say that no one in Missouri is allowed to fly an airplane.
Or fly out of an airport, even.
Right. So, I mean, one side or the other is going to have to back down, and I guess it's an open question which side would, but clearly that's not actually going to happen, right?
Yeah, and a lot of state legislators are cowed by the federal threat. They don't really realize that if they were to hold the line and refuse to implement Real ID, frankly, the way it would happen in sort of real politics is that the Air Transport Association would be on Capitol Hill day before yesterday saying, Congress, you have to change this law because otherwise a substantial percentage of our business is going away. If any state refuses to implement Real ID, and I'm sure several will, in fact, we can come to that. If any state, though, refuses to implement it, the program essentially collapses because all airports will have to accommodate travelers that don't show ID. And so if that were to happen, we'd get more sense in our air security programs than we have now, where everybody shows ID as if that does something to protect us.
Is there also a purse strings aspect to it? I mean, do states lose money if they don't implement it?
Well, the purse strings actually just kicked in today, and so that's a good question. Up to this point, the federal government has come up with almost no money to get states to comply. They allocated about, I think, $30 or $40 million nationwide, and the estimate from the National Conference of State Legislatures was that it would cost $11 billion to comply. So there was no money available. But apparently today, DHS announced that they will make a certain percentage of Homeland Security grant program funds available to states to implement Real ID. So the plot to get this thing put in place, even though it's very nearly impossible and very, very expensive, is thickening as the federal money tree is starting to rain down money, and it will attempt to weaken the state legislatures that have objected to this thing. So, like I said, the plot is thickening, and we will see if states are going to stand up for their citizens' privacy rights and prerogatives, or if they're going to buckle at the sight of all these wonderful federal dollars, which, after all, we should keep in mind are their own residents' taxpayer dollars, but they seem to think it's manna from heaven.
Hey, Jim, so I saw Susan Collins, who is a senator from Maine, if I'm not mistaken, introduce an amendment to the 9/11 bill that's now at the Senate that would change the Real ID Act somehow?
Well, yeah, very interesting developments. Maine was the first state to pass a resolution against Real ID, and both the House and Senate on the same day, Maine said, we don't like this, return to sender. Collins, within very short order, introduced a bill to delay implementation. This plays right into the hands of the Real ID proponents because it gives them more time to shake the federal money tree. Mm-hmm. It gives them more time to wear down the states and put together the programs. Listen, let's be frank. The surveillance industrial complex, which is what the ACLU calls it, the businesses that want to sell stuff to government, the databases and networks and so on and so forth, they're going to swarm state government saying, hey, let's do this. Let's get this done. You know, it's all about security. You can't not, you know, you can't say no to security. And they'll swarm over the next couple of years. They'll be swarming the states just like they swarm the federal government trying to make this thing happen. And so Collins really did that bunch a big favor. She's come out in favor of Real ID and a national ID when her state is unanimously against it. I think there were four votes that support or refuse to resist Real ID in the state legislature, House and Senate both. So she's way off the ranch. It's pretty remarkable. And recognizing this, Tom Allen, a representative from Maine, has introduced a bill that would repeal Real ID and replace it with the ID provisions of the December 2004 law. So he's recognizing the political tea leaves. I think he may run against Collins in the next election. He's in the House. He happens to know what the interests of Mainers are, and seems to be working on supporting those interests, which is a clever political device.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Jim. Next up, we're going to talk about Rick Boucher's new fair use bill. And Rick Boucher, Tim, I guess has been a real champion, a first use and real champion against the DMCA. And you've written a lot about this. So tell us what's going on here.
Yeah, well, Rick Boucher, as you said, has been the traditional standard bearer for DMCA reform legislation. In the previous two Congresses, he introduced legislation that was called the Digital Millennium Copyright – I'm sorry, Digital Consumer Rights Act – which would have allowed circumvention of copy protection and, most importantly, the distribution of circumvention devices because, you know, for example, there's an exception that allows you blind users to use the read-aloud function on ebooks, but it's still legal to sell a blind user software that would allow them to take advantage of
it. Now, let's not get ahead of ourselves here. Can you explain just quickly what the DMCA is and how it applies to copyright?
Oh, sure. Well, the DMCA is a law that was passed in 1998 that had several provisions. The one that I and Boucher have traditionally been most concerned about is the provision that makes it a crime to circumvent copy protection schemes. For example, when you download a song from iTunes, there's software in iTunes that makes it difficult for you to make illicit copies of the songs you download. And this has had a number of problems because it effectively gives Apple the power to say which software is allowed to manipulate content that's downloaded from iTunes.
So if you bought something fair and square, the song has software in it that prevents you from playing it somewhere else or moving it somewhere else?
That's right. So if you purchased the music from iTunes and you wanted to play it on your Dell or Sony MP3 player, there's no legal way for you to do that.
And so Boucher's old bill would have allowed you to, taken away that provision.
Right. Boucher's bill said that you're allowed to distribute devices if they had substantial non-infringing uses, which is the standard that the Supreme Court handed down in the 1980s with respect to VCRs. And would have allowed any device that meets that standard to be distributed. Now, the current bill, and so in 2003 and 2005, he introduced legislation to that effect. The current legislation still has some exceptions that allow people to engage in circumvention, but what he's dropped is the provision that allows distribution of circumvention devices. So you still would technically have the right to circumvent certain kinds of copy protection, but only if you happen to be a DRM hacker.
You'd have to make your own circumvention device. You'd have to write your own program.
You'd have to write your own software, and obviously most consumers don't have the ability to do that. And more importantly, I think most of the really innovative software is done by software firms or open source communities. They're not developed by a single person. So it really dampens the opportunity for, say, the next MP3 player or the next VCR to be developed because anybody who's not doesn't work for an existing media platform is not allowed to develop new devices that use content from these services. Now, I should say that the The other provision of the voucher bill that I do think has quite a bit of merit is basically a reaction to the Grokster decision in 2005, which held that Grokster was a peer-to-peer file sharing site, held that that was illegal. And it basically reduces the liability of secondary infringers in general, which are companies that help other people to engage in copyright infringement, and also also specifically exempts hardware manufacturers if they meet the Sony test of substantial non-infringing use. And I think there's a lot to be said for those provisions. I think, you know, if I were in Congress, I would vote for them. The strange thing is that Boucher, in his press release and his other materials, is not talking about those provisions. He's focusing on these DMCA provisions that, as far as I can see, would have little or no effect. And I guess that's because there's a large number of people who are more upset about the DMCA than they are about the Grokster liability type issues, and he's hoping he can get political mileage about it. But I would have liked to see a little bit more truth in advertising to say that, you know, that Boucher's just decided that these Grokster issues are more important, so he's decided to introduce legislation focusing on those, and he's put the DMCA on the back burner and has maybe planned to look at that in future Congresses.
So Tim, what do you make of the possibilities of the bill passing? Is he in a good position with it? Is there a lot of support?
Well, I'm not in Congress, so I'm probably not the right person to ask. My sense is that the provision that the recording industry is going to dislike the most is the provision that says that statutory damages cannot be applied to secondary infringers. And what that means is that traditionally when you're found, when you're sued and you're found liable, the amount you have to pay is in some sense proportional to the harm you've done. But copyright law has what's called statutory damages, which are damages that are set by legally to a specific dollar figure, and in many cases they're in the thousands of dollars. And the problem with that is that if you are the inventor of some new device and you are found guilty of copyright infringement, you can be charged, you know, $10,000 per copy. And if that's allegedly been infringed, if there's a million copies, that's $10 billion. You know, no startup can pay for that. And so what it ends up being a very powerful weapon for copyright holders, where basically if they win the first round of court decisions, the startup has no choice but to settle, because otherwise they're going to be driven into bankruptcy anyway. My sense is that the MPAA and the RIAA are not going to be willing to are still going to oppose it, and I think the RIAA released a press release yesterday denouncing it, but I think its chances are a little bit better, because they might not oppose it quite as strenuously as they did the DMCA reform stuff that was in the previous bill.
Well, Tim, let me ask you, are you saying that you would go so far as to say that no type of statutory damages should be applied to any sort of contributory infringement activity that a court of law finds someone is guilty of? I mean, there are cases where it's pretty clear-cut when some companies are going above and beyond just facilitating a certain type of use. They're actually benefiting from the ripping off of certain types of copyright. So, I mean, I would be a little bit skeptical here about should Congress come in and say, we're not going to allow any damages to be imposed in those cases. Is that what's happening here?
Well, it's not any damages. It's
statutory.
It's statutory damages. So you still would be able to demonstrate the actual damage that's being caused, and you might even be able to add, you know, punitive damages that are some multiple of that. But also the voucher bill, what it says is that the copyright holder that's suing has to demonstrate that no reasonable person could have believed that such conduct to be lawful. And so that protects, if you have an area where there's an unsettled area of law, it ensures that the innovator has, you know, the sort of give the innovator the benefit of the doubt, where if he was legitimately unsure if it was legal or not, you don't hit him with these draconian penalties. Now, if you have a settled area of law, like if someone went out and did exactly what Grokster did, I think then you would have a pretty strong case that, you know, there was no reasonable argument to be made that they were not liable, and then you still could potentially have statutory damages.
All right, Tim. Thanks a lot. Finally, we're going to talk about the fine levied against Univision by the FCC. And I guess, Adam, you're going to talk to us about this. What happened here was that Univision ran afoul of the Children's Television Act, which requires 3 hours of educational programming per week. And it's part of a deal with the FCC to get they're being bought out by an equity group. They agreed to a fine?
Yeah, this is really quite a stunning development, Jerry, and it shows you just how completely out of step the Federal Communications is with modern media realities, because a $24 million fine on a foreign language broadcaster for not airing something that the FCC found was educational enough is being imposed on them while millions of other types of educational programming is available to people on a variety of different platforms. So one wonders, what's the problem here? Why is our government continuing to enforce a law from, you know, 1990 that said you had to air a certain number of hours of educational programming, a law which shouldn't have existed, of course. But why in the world do we continue to mandate that in a world where you don't go to Univision to find educational programming necessarily? And yet that's what the FCC is doing, and doing it here to the tune of $24 million, which is a historic fine, greater than even those indecency fines that we were writing so much about on the tech liberation front over the past couple of years that the FCC has been handing down. So this is really, you know, completely out of touch with marketplace and modern media realities, and yet this commission and Kevin Martin, its chairman, seem obsessed with regulating every type of programming on broadcast television.
Is there anything? Is there anything to the idea that because this is a Spanish language television, the choices are more limited in the Spanish language for education?
Well, even if that's the case, there's certainly more of those choices today than ever before, and I think people who speak Spanish, are probably going to be able to find other types of content, whether it be from VHS tapes or satellite programming. This is one of the biggest growth markets, by the way, for cable and satellite, is the foreign language component of the digital tiers. It's absolutely exploding right now. So one could argue, yeah, there's not as much of it there as there is English language material, but, you know, that's to be expected in some ways. But the fact is, it's growing. And why is it that we're imposing these sorts of rules on a specific type of foreign language broadcaster and not on everybody else? I mean, they shouldn't apply to anybody, basically. You should go out and find educational programming somewhere else. You shouldn't necessarily just be looking for it on Univision.
Jim, you had a question?
Let me just say that I used to watch Univision as a youth myself. El Show de Iris Chacon was some of the best educational television I ever saw. My dad and I would watch that and Sabado Gigante all the time for the fine dancing that was displayed there. But more seriously, I wanted to ask, this penalty is being levied in the course of a transaction, so it's sort of a pound of flesh that the FCC is doing? Is that what's going
exactly
on
here? Exactly. Yeah, once again, it's regulatory blackmail. I mean, the FCC is resorting to extortionary tactics. They know they've got Univision in a bind. They need to get a deal approved. They're being acquired by a couple of other companies. And I should mention as an aside, very interesting side note most people don't realize, one of the companies that is acquiring Univision is Providence Equity Partners. Now, Providence Partners happens to have as its number one advisor on the deal a certain man by the name of Michael Powell, who happened to be the chairman of the FCC and who Kevin Martin absolutely hates. And so, I don't know, maybe you can put the pieces of the puzzle together there and realize that these guys, you know, absolutely despised each other when they were on the commission together, and all of a sudden Michael Powell's engineering a big merger, and wham, down comes a $24 million fine. Smells a bit fishy to me. But, of course, the commission issued a statement, and Kevin Martin said that, quote, it wasn't a factor at all, and that he did not know Michael Powell was involved in the deal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Adam, do these regulations apply to premium cable and satellite channels, or is Univision
they're a broadcaster
broadcast somewhere?
And this does not apply to cable and satellite, nor any other type of media. And that again points to how illogical these rules are in an age of media multiplicity and media abundance. I mean, why in the world are we imposing these sorts of rules or the indecency rules on any one class of speakers or providers of media content? And it's quite insane that you would think that you can enforce these in any rational way going forward, because of course a lot of that programming is going to be migrating to the web. It probably is already there, and I don't know about it yet. But in light of that, one wonders what happens. Are we going to have, you know, children's television requirements on the web? Well, guess what? That's actually been debated at the FCC, and there are questions. There are actually rules at the FCC right now because of the Children's Television Act that say if you on your broadcast television station are showing a program and then list a web link that points a kid, say, who's watching Dora the Explorer to the Nickelodeon website, there are then new FCC rules that apply to the Nickelodeon website as a pass-through. So that shows you the danger of how technological convergence can lead to regulatory convergence and how the FCC can come knocking at you through the back door and get you that way.
So the Univision is broadcast somewhere? Because I didn't know. I thought they were just a cable channel.
Yeah, well, of course, they're cable. They're carried on cable networks, but they are a broadcast, a licensed broadcast operator in America. Yes, so, I mean, they're carried on almost every cable and satellite system because they're very, very popular in the Spanish-speaking language market. So,
right.
You know, that doesn't mean, though, that they're a cable, primarily a cable operator.
All right, thanks a lot, Adam.
Chihuahua.
Thanks, Adam. Before we go, any other quick bit that caught your eye this week, guys?
Yeah, well, I'll start. We didn't have time to talk about it in detail, but the Supreme Court heard the case of Microsoft v. AT&T last week, which is a very fascinating case that looks at the patentability of software, and in particular whether a software company that exports software overseas is liable for patent infringement for the copies of the software that are sold overseas. And that should be getting handed down within the next few months, so hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about that in more detail.
All right. I wanted to mention real quickly this brouhaha that happened over C-SPAN's recordings of House hearings, and basically Nancy Pelosi had been taking video that had been posted to the C-SPAN website that C-SPAN had recorded and putting it on her own blog. And the House Republican Study Committee put out a press release calling foul on her and saying that she was a pirate, because she was taking C-SPAN's copyrighted material. And, of course, C-SPAN set the record straight and said, no, you know, this is a government work. This is basically just a government-owned camera that's just shooting this thing, and we're just taking that and putting it on C-SPAN. It's saying, however, there is material that we shoot, that we send out our camera crews to, that is copyrighted. And what I think is interesting is that William Patry, who is a renowned copyright expert, professor at NYU, says, actually, that's not copyrighted either. One of the requirements of copyright is that you have to have originality. And just having a camera shooting, you know, just one angle, a politician speaking, does not make for enough originality to be copyright. So maybe everything C-SPAN does as far as hearings go isn't copyrighted either, so it's a free-for-all.
I'll tell you my tidbit of the week if you'd like to hear it.
Yeah.
The case where a company or a group was going to demonstrate if Black Hat Federal, the hack that they'd done against the HID key cards, RFID-based key cards that a lot of us are familiar with, they had developed, I think using some HID readers, had developed a mobile reader so that they could pull your key card information out of your wallet, you know, walking behind you or something like that, and then go up to the doorway of your office building or warehouse or whatever and be able to get in. HID suggested that they might respond with a patent lawsuit because they had used some patented technology to do this thing, and it's a direct repeat of what you saw at Black Hat in Las Vegas a year ago or a year or two ago, where somebody was going to demonstrate a flaw in, I think, a Cisco systems technology, and Cisco sued to try to prevent this security lapse from getting out. It's a great example of the cover-up being worse than the crime. HID should get out front and fix that security flaw, and all of us should be aware that advancing technology may de-secure things that were secure in the past. And the last thing they should be doing is suing, especially on the basis of patent, to try to cover up the fact that there's a security issue there.
Companies do the same thing with the DMCA. There's a case where Blackboard sued some students who had done a paper on some security flaws with Blackboard software. And it's the same sort of idea. Instead of fixing the problem, they try to use the DMCA to prevent the disclosure of it.
Adam, any tidbit from you?
Well, I'll just mention that we talked a lot last week about the Skype-XM proposed merger, and this week it had its first hearing in Congress, and it did not go well for Mel Karmazin, the chairman of Sirius, where all his enemies and competitors came out and basically said, don't allow them to merge. It'll be a monopoly, even though why would they be there if, you know, they really thought that? I mean, they're obviously his competitor and fear that they will actually be a stronger player in the market if they're allowed to merge. But the bottom line is what came out of that is that it appears one concession that they were going to make was pulled off the table while another one was put on. What was taken off the table, apparently, is that they thought that Sirius and XM would agree to a la carte regulation or a la carte selling of channels or programs on the satellite dial so that maybe Howard Stern and other things were sold at a premium and separately apart from the overall bundle of service. And that was largely to kowtow to those who fear that, oh, we need to clean up satellite and take racy stuff off the basic dial. Even though you're already paying $13 a month for it, you know, why in the world would we have to pay more to get access to what we want? Regardless, that's a sticking point, and Kevin Martin will want it because he wants it for basic cable television. and apparently Syria said originally they might do it or hinted they would, and now they've taken it off. On the other hand, yesterday it came out that they would be willing to agree to some sort of a price freeze or price cap for 2 years or something like that, which is something that a lot of the quote-unquote consumer groups are advocating, the idea that we should freeze prices in that market for 2 to 3 years.
Wow.
Even though they're paying so much money for all that talent that they're signing up, God only knows how they're going to pay it off if they have a price freeze on for 3 years plus.
All right. Well, thanks
a lot.
So
stay tuned on that.
Well, that's going to be it for Tech Policy Weekly this time. To read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, visit us at techliberation.com. And I hear the sirens are coming for Jim Harper.
I got to run. See you later.
Also, if you have something to say about something we said, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for the show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Jerry Brito. Goodbye.